Last week, we were looking at Exodus chapter 17, and there were two main events that we saw in that chapter regarding the exodus of Israel from Egypt. First, it says they journeyed by segments into the wilderness. One of the people I worked with a lot, you'd ask him how things were going, they would say steady by jerks. That's a common thing. That appears to be a somewhat of an explanation here. They had smaller journeys that worked into a bigger journey, and they went to the wilderness of Sin and camped at Rephidim. At Rephidim, there was no water. So what did the people do? Well, they quarreled with Moses. Moses' response to that is, "Why do you test the Lord?" How was their quarreling with Moses and their angst about the water a test of the Lord?
It was the Lord that led them there.
Lord led them there.
He's provided for them everything they needed so far.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that they would not have confidence by now that the Lord was going to take care of them at every step along the way. And yet, I'm sure we could find many examples where we behave the same way. And of course, the people's response to Moses saying, "Why are you quarreling with me?" They say, "We're thirsty. You bring us out here to kill us, our children, and all of our animals." How dramatic can you make it? With thirst. What did Moses say to God about the people? Remember?
What shall I do with them?
Yeah, what shall I do to them? Because
they're about ready to stone me.
I don't know if I'm going to physically survive this. Now, when I was teaching through this, I didn't see it exactly this way. But there's a hint of testing God here too, isn't there? Moses, you faced down Pharaoh. Well, no, you didn't. But you were my voice and my mouthpiece to face down Pharaoh. And you're worried about these people? I mean, come on, Moses. So he is, I think, in God's eyes, less offensive than the people. But it's got the same vein to it a little bit. And so what did the Lord have Moses to do? Well, he said, take some elders with you. Pass before the people. Let them see you doing this. Take your staff and strike the rock. And Moses did that. They got their water. It was a place that Moses named Massah and Meribah. Massah means temptation and Meribah means strife. So it was a place that the people went through temptation, didn't do so well with it, and they had strife. And then the second event of chapter 17, while they were still at Rephidim, Amalek came and fought Israel. And Amalek is the grandson of Esau, the twin with Jacob. And by the way, last week I stumbled around and got the wrong children's names out there, and I got some help. I don't know who spoke up and corrected me, but thank you for doing that. Don't ever think you might embarrass me, and I don't care about that. Embarrass me anyway. Let's get it right. Thank you for getting me back on the right names and the right families. But Amalek, grandson of Esau had moved his clan down south of the Dead Sea, and that's where they were. There wasn't room for both he and Jacob up in the land of Canaan. And so Amalek, the people of Amalek, the Amalekites, we would come to call them, came down to attack. And Joshua was sent out to lead a military response. Moses told him he would, but he stationed himself at the top of the hill. He said he would have his staff in his hand, and he took along with him Aaron and Hur. And who was Hur? Do you remember? The
son of Caleb.
The son of Caleb. And very quickly they realized that when Moses would have his hands up with the staff, they were winning. When he would lower his hands, then the Amalekites would be winning. And what was their solution to that?
Moses, hold his hands.
Yeah, set him down on a rock, get his hands down where we can reach him, and Aaron and Hur would hold his hands up, and as a result, Amalek was overwhelmed. It did take all day. It was a one-day battle, which in one sense is quick, but when you're as directly involved as Moses was, I'm sure that was a long day. What was God's response concerning Amalek, the Amalekites to come? Do you remember?
Destroy them all.
Yeah, God says, I'm gonna blot them out. And talked about having a perpetual war with them, God himself. And we talked about how that would show up in the life of Saul, in the life of David, and then ultimately in the book of Esther. Haman was a descendant of Amalek through Agag. That's why I was trying to say Agar, and I knew that wasn't quite right. And Moses there builds an altar where he says, the Lord is my banner, and the basic meaning of that, the Lord becomes the standard. He is the one that's not only caring for them, but it is who he is and his nature that becomes their standard. And Moses is also directed to write it down in a book and as a citation, and to read it to Joshua that this is going to be the case about his perpetual war with the Amalekites. And so all of that is established. Any questions or comments about last week? Well, let's begin with chapter 18, and first we're going to look at the first 12 verses, and I'll read those for us. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah, and after he had sent her away, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for Moses had said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. The other was named Eliezer, for he had said, the God of my fathers was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was camped at the Mount of God. He sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Then Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had befallen on them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses, father-in-law, before God. And so Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, he's a priest of Midian, and we probably ought to remind ourselves a little bit about him, or at least where he comes up earlier. First of all, turn back to chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 3 in Exodus, verses 1 and 2. Oops, went one too far. Back up a page. And it says, Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So when Moses has his burning bush experience, he is out there with the flocks of his father-in-law. He had met his wife Zipporah earlier. What was he doing when he met Zipporah in Midian. How did he get to Midian? Why did he go? What?
He was run out of Egypt by Pharaoh.
Yeah, he was trying to flee from Egypt because
he killed an Egyptian.
He killed an Egyptian, and Pharaoh said, I'm going to kill him. Moses decided not to make it easy and went to Midian, intending to escape that. And so he takes care of this flock for his father-in-law, Jethro, and that's exactly what he's doing when he is in the burning bush experience. Turn over to chapter 4. Let's look at verses 18 through 20. Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law. This is after the burning bush experience. And said to him, please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who are seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. So what we see here is Moses' departure. Whose permission did he ask to go? Father-in-law. And what did he tell him as the reason for going? The Lord told me to. I'm going back to my people. And the Lord also told him that the one that wanted to kill him was dead. And who does Moses take with him?
His wife and his sons.
Took his family, his wife and his sons. So we run into kind of an interesting thing here. First of all, Jethro is the priest of Midian. Now, does that mean he's a priest representing God? Somebody said an answer and I didn't hear it.
No.
And it probably is right. I mean, we don't have a definitive answer at this point. Who are the Midianites? Remember? Now I'm asking you to reach back a long ways. What's that? Nope. What's that? Abraham's second wife. Her name was Keturah. After Sarah died, he had a whole nother family. And generally, the children that he had with Keturah went to the area that became known as Midian. And so they had settled down in that area. Now, would you call those people Jewish or Gentile? Gentile. Why? To be Jewish, who did you need to be an descendant of?
Abraham.
Not just Abraham. Jacob. Because the promise actually would be maybe even more accurate to say Isaac. Isaac was the child of the promise. The promise to Abraham did not extend to other children. Ishmael, the children of Keturah. And so it's an interesting thing to think about, because when I thought about that for this lesson today, I'm thinking, you know, I never really thought about it that way, but the Arabs through Ishmael, I always think, when I say the word Gentile, I think of people like me. I mean, this is like at Christmas time, how many of your pictures of Jesus being born or later on when he's crucified, how many of those are pictures that show white people? You know, we tend to think of people like ourselves. So when I think of Gentiles, I think of the Western world or things like that. I hadn't really stopped and thought about Abraham had a lot of offspring that if you wanted to say Gentile or Jew, you'd have to say Gentile because they were not children of the promise. Only the Jewish people were the children of the promise. And so you've got all the Arabs who are descendants of Abraham. And you've also got these children of Keturah who are descendants of Abraham, but they're not children of the promise. And Midian was known as an area with lots of foreign god worship, lots of false god worship. And so in all probability, he was a priest, mostly representing foreign gods. maybe a better way to say other, not just foreign gods, but tended to be multiple god worshipers. In other words, they had all the gods for all the things, and maybe they had some category for the God of Abraham, I don't know, but it wouldn't have been focused on that. But he's a priest in Media. They were generally idolaters, and not in Jacob's line. And so in verse 1, it continued. It said, he had heard that all had God had done for Moses. How did he hear? Well, word of mouth, that's about all we've got in that era, right? And in reading about how this kind of information was transmitted, it really worked a lot better than we might think, because you've got all of the traders going around. And they're constantly on the move. There were a lot of Arab traders in that area. And so they would be constantly on the move, and were, you know, every time somebody, hey, did you hear what happened over there at the Red Sea? You know, I mean, it's going to get out there. And even in the Song of Moses, they talk about how the nations fear after this sea crossing. They know, and they shake in their boots, so to speak. And so Jethro had heard a lot. Somehow he knew that Jethro was in the vicinity of Midian again. He was back there. And so Jethro had been caring for his daughter, who was Moses' wife, Zipporah, and the two children, it says in verse 2, after Moses had sent her away. I tried to find some reference, when did Moses send her away? And I just did not find anything that I could turn to. One of you may find something or know something. If you do, please bring it up. But verse 2 here in chapter 18 is the only situation I could find where it mentions at all Moses having sent her to her father. And so her father was caring for her. And she had her two sons that were fathered by Moses, Gershom. And he said, because I'm a sojourner. Well, Gershom means foreigner. And Eliezer, because God was my help. Well, that means God is help. And so here they are. And he said, the God of my father, my help, delivered me from Pharaoh's sword. And this is the first Pharaoh, because it wasn't the Pharaoh of the Red Sea crossing is not the person that was Pharaoh when Moses left Egypt, almost certainly. And so the first Pharaoh, well, we know certainly, because the first Pharaoh, the one that initially wanted to kill him, was dead. And that was occurred before Moses went back. And so Moses went back. That threat is over. And so now he is back in Egypt, and then would come back now here to Midian. And so Jethro, knowing he was here, came down to see him. And he brought Moses' sons and his wife. And he brought them to Moses as they were camped in the wilderness at the Mount of the God. So they're in the vicinity of the Mountain of God, or Mount Sinai, as they're making this camp. And I don't know how, other than word of mouth, but Jethro knew Moses' general location. So he gets down close, but he doesn't just barge into camp. He sent word to Moses that I'm here and I'm coming to you and I have your family. So in verse 7, Moses went out to meet him, and they bowed down, they kissed each other, or Moses kissed him, and they asked of each other's welfare. I mean, you can imagine this doesn't sound too different than how we live. We might not run to the kissing part, we might shake hands, but nonetheless, hey, it's good to see you, and how you been doing? They have that, what's your welfare, what's going on in your life, what's happened, I hope things are well with you. And in verse 8, Moses then downloads to Jethro the account of the events, including what God had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptian and the hardships that Israel would have been through. What would you expect was the main theme of Moses' account? If you had to narrow it down to a summary sentence.
God provides.
It was tough, but God took us through. I mean, how could you tell the events that went on, the hardships, and how they had survived their way through it with and leave out the work that God had done to take them through it? So Moses brought that forward. Jethro has a response in verse 9. He rejoiced. He was pleased. He was excited in his soul of all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel. And we're going to pay attention to this a little bit as we go through it. When he says Lord here, he calls him Jehovah or Yahweh, whichever, however you want to say it. And how Jehovah had taken them out of Israel, had taken them out from under the bondage of Pharaoh and out from under the Egyptians. And this is the way he says it in verse 10. Blessed be the Lord who delivered you. And once again, it's Jehovah, from the hands of the Egyptians and from Pharaoh, and delivered his people from slavery by the Egyptians. And verse 11, I think, is very important. Now I know, says Jethro, the Lord, Jehovah, is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. And I spent a little bit of time with this trying to figure out who was proud? What did they do against which people? You could read this a couple of different ways, but I think it's pretty clear after I stopped and spent some time with it. And first of all, that word proudly, what word gets used in other translations there in verse 11?
Arrogantly.
Arrogantly, that's a really good word. And when I look at this, he was talking about, in the context of verse 11, is the Lord is greater than all the gods. It was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. So who's the they there that dealt proudly?
The Egyptians.
The Egyptians. And in representing their gods, they were arrogant. Was Pharaoh arrogant at every turn?
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm not letting you do anything, Moses. Even after the plagues, and he would make a deal with Moses to get the plague lifted, he'd turn right back around and then go, no, not going to do that. And we looked at how most of that interaction was God showing that the false gods that Egypt was following were indeed false. Many of those plagues were direct statements against those gods, statements of action by Jehovah, by the God of Abraham, to show that they were no gods at all. Compared to him, there was no power there. And so you could also say rebelliously would be another translation there. Might not be as good, because if we're talking about the Egyptians, yes, they were rebelling against God, but it really was their putting forward their own gods against the Israelites, acting like they're superior, and they really had the power to keep the Israelites from getting out from under their slavery in Egypt. And so they were arrogant against the people. And here is Jethro saying, by the way these people, through the application of their gods, treated the people of Israel, I am fully convinced that Jehovah is greater than any other god you want to talk about, than all gods. And so something is happening within Jethro regarding what he sees as the God that is in charge, that is truly almighty. Questions, comments so far? Okay. So in verse 12, Jethro stops and he offers a burnt offering and sacrifices toward God. And interestingly enough here, the words he uses are, the word that is used here in verse 12, I want to put it back in my head instead of just my notes here. Oops, wrong chapter. Get back over here to 18:12. Took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron with all the elders came to eat. And Here, the text uses the word Elohim, which is interesting. And I'm doing my homework trying to figure out, okay, why the word shift? John MacArthur, in his write-ups, both in his study Bible and other places, talks about that the reason for the use of the word Elohim is that this would be the name that Gentiles would be more likely to use. A proselyte would use this kind of a word. And that's where the issue of Jethro not being a Jew but being a Gentile puts him in this proselyte category. And that's where John MacArthur goes with it. When I look at the word in terms of its definitions, it just seems God who is mighty, God who is great. And it makes sense with the context here, because Jethro has just declared the greatness of God. He's greater than any other god, so it emphasizes greatness. I don't know. Probably all of those thoughts have merit, and that's what's going on here. But he offers this burnt offering, and then Aaron and all the elders of Israel come and have a meal, maybe a feast, with Jethro. And the reason I say feast is because the text says before God. And again, we use Elohim. So Jehovah emphasizes the covenant relationship. Elohim emphasizes the greatness of God. And so here's Jethro coming. He hears what's going on. And in essence, he just breaks out in praise of God, affirmation of God, worship of God, and fellowships with the Jewish people, the Jewish leadership, and Aaron in this time of recognizing what God has done. Okay, any comments or thoughts through verse 12 there? Yes. Yes. Yeah?
Every Jew is a descendant. When you think about it, is a descendant of a Gentile.
Yeah, he didn't start out being a, quote, Jew.
No.
They weren't.
And many of his descendants are not Jews. In fact,
yes.
Most.
Well, yeah, most. Most are not Jews.
He fathered many, many Gentiles.
And the interesting thing is, maybe not even near as interesting as just recognizing that what it meant to be a Jew didn't happen till the child of the promise came. It's through the child that these things are going to happen. But the opposers of the children of the child of the promise, the Jews, the opposers are very often related also children of Abraham. Whether you're talking about the lineage through Ishmael or the lineage through Esau, you have all of these people that would readily, quickly wipe out the children of the promise. Very, very few would join themselves in a proselyte way to the promise. Very few did. And, of course, this continues through history. You can see it at the time Jesus was born. Who was the ruler over Israel? Anybody know? Herod. What's Herod's lineage? He's an Edomite.
Yeah, that's right.
Child of Esau. In the lineage of Esau. And when he hears that a baby has been born somewhere by these traveling wise men, is what we call them. Today we would probably call them astronomers or astrologists. I'm not sure which one of those would be closer, probably astrologists. But anyhow, they came because they saw the star and they knew that something grand had happened. And from their understanding, they're looking for a baby born to be king and Messiah. And when Herod, a child of Esau, long ways descendant, hears of it, what does he try to do?
Kill him.
It's amazing that the biggest contentions in history have often included people who were also said, Abraham is our father. Now, don't get me wrong, the Western world's gotten involved with it too. And we see some very egregious times in the last century where the Jews were hated and tried to be wiped out. And of course, we know the stories that are going on today. But it's just fascinating to me. All right. Anything else? Good point. Let's pick it up with verse 13, and I'm going to read through the rest of the chapter. It came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around about Moses from morning until the evening. Now, when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this thing you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning until evening?" Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and make known the statutes of God and his laws." In verse 17, continuing, Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I will give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people will go to their place in peace." So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. They judged the people at all times, the difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way to his own land. So the next day, they had this feast. Jethro's there in the camp. There's been some interaction with the Jewish leadership, and the next day Moses sat to judge, and he held court to settle the issues of the people. How long did it take?
All day.
Have you ever been to court and felt like, you know, either as a potential juror or something, maybe you had to testify? I've had to do that a few times. That went pretty quick, didn't it? How did you feel at the end of the day? I mean, I've been there, been on juries, and nothing happens quickly. And I think these people, can you imagine, everybody's going to show up. Of course, which case is Moses going to handle first? Well, we don't know. I'm making it up because I don't know either. But I'm guessing they kind of got in line and in order, right? Any of you folks fly Southwest? Okay. You want to be at the front of the line, right? How do you accomplish that?
Early.
Show up early. And so, well, you can pay money now. When I was doing most of my flying, they didn't offer the purchasing of a seniority or purchasing a position. It was purely what time you showed up and when you checked in. So you got there, you want to be first. I never made it first, but I got in the early parts most of the time. But anyway, so here are these people, and I'm guessing they probably rushed to get there because they want to go first. And so can you imagine getting there, and you come around the corner, and you say, reminds me of going to Canada and trying to cross the border on Saturday morning and fishing trips. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say the first time we did it, we didn't know what we were doing, and about 9 o'clock we got to the border, and I'll bet the line was somewhere around 4 miles long that we got in. Oh, I've never seen so many trucks and boats in a row, and ever. Anyway. Can you imagine the feeling? You come around the corner and you go, oh, my idea early wasn't near early enough. And so here are these people there, and Moses is judging them. Jethro watches it.
Did you really say, oh, my?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing that, yeah, never mind. Don't want to go there. Too much time. Don't want to take time for it. But Jethro watches all day, and I give Jethro a lot of strong points here. As a father-in-law, probably a little bit older man, if my son was doing this and I came around the corner and saw he's got this line, I probably would not have been able to keep quiet. I would probably have interrupted and go, what are you doing? But Jethro didn't do that. He let it go on. He watched all day long. And when it's over, then he asked Moses, and I'm guessing there was a lot in the tone. What are you doing? Maybe not. Maybe it was a very benign tone. Why are you the only one holding court and doing it all day long? Now, I think Moses' answer reveals a lot about how Moses thought about leadership. Well, the people come to inquire about God. I'm the one they come to. I mean, there wasn't any real initiative in his answer. You know, the problem was pretty evident, I think. They're all day long doing this, and so he's, why are you doing it this way? And it's like, I didn't even think about any alternatives. It's just the way we were doing it. So Moses continues and says, disputes are brought to me, and I judge between them while teaching the orders of God and his laws. Jethro has one comment. This is not good. You're killing yourself. That's my way of rephrasing what he said. And the people. It's not sustainable. You can't keep this going. It's too much for one person. And he's got a point. Moses is getting worn out, no doubt about it. But the people that stand in line all day are getting worn out too, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a grueling thing. I mean, I've got some tricks I use when it's time for me to buy tags, because I don't really want to get in a line when everybody else thinks it's the right day to buy tags. I don't want to be number 9 on the list. It gets old. It gets tiresome. And Jethro's saying the people aren't going to put up with it either. Listen to me. I'm going to tell you a better way to do this, and God will be with you. He doesn't leave God out of this discussion. He's both directive and yet trusting in the way he talks about God's role in this. And he basically is taking his wisdom plus direction from God and strength from God to do all this. And he says, you be the one to represent the people to God. He did not take that role away from Moses to go talk to God on behalf of the people. But what he says was, and you can bring disputes to God, but he says, then teach the people the laws and how to walk and how to work. Tell them how, teach them so they know what's expected of them and how to, what laws they have to obey, how they're to walk their lives, what does it mean to live their lives. So they're not just talking about legal things, and also how to work, how to be productive, how to be good citizens. And so this is the direction that Jethro gives to Moses. Teach him these things, then, after the people have an understanding, delegate this job of judging the people. And he gives them some very good qualifications that would work in any society. Select able men. Now, this isn't to put anybody down or to raise anybody up. But we can look around us and get a pretty good idea of men that we would go, this man, is his makeup, his composition would work well as a judge. And you could look at somebody else and go, you know, if I need this work done. I'm going to hire him, but I don't want him as a judge. I want him doing what fits him. And so pick men who are equipped to be judges, who are able, but they've got to fear God. And I like that word fear. That's more than be a believer. There's got to be a recognition of accountability for living in this life. They've also got to be honest men, truthful men. You don't want to do judging based on lies, and you don't want judgments made and proclaimed that are not truthful either. And then here's a huge one. And this is the one that's so hard to find in the world of mankind that we live in. Hate dishonest gain. Not just men that refuse to get involved with it, but men that hate it. So that hatred of dishonest gain can come out in their own behavior. They're not going to be a part of it, but they can also judge with proper severity those that do get involved in it. Now, we could, if there was a way to implement this well before anyone ran for office, wouldn't this be great? Would it revolutionize every country in the world? Yeah. Yeah, it really would. And then Jethro goes on, place these men as leaders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Bring some structure to it. And you can imagine, it's not directly stated here, but you can imagine that the men over tens are going to be your first line, right? Aren't they? They're going to have 10 families or groups of people that they're going to be responsible for, and you bring it to them. And if he goes, this is bigger than us, it's going to keep going up the chain. And actually, ultimately in verse 22, he says, let them do the daily judging and bring to only to you the major issues. And so ultimately, their equivalent of the Supreme Court would be Moses. When we can't get it dealt with at a lower level appropriately, we're going to take it up to Moses, and then you just deal with those ones that you have to deal with. You're the only one that can deal with it. Otherwise, it's going to work its way up its chain with these men taking care of the lesser ones. And there in verse 22, he goes on to say, and here's the expected result. This is going to be easier for you. They will share the load. And so Jethro is expecting that these men will bear some of the burden that Moses has taken on in trying to deal with everything. And there's some real wisdom in here that goes beyond just Moses' time management. If you've got one person that makes every judgment about everything, what attitude is likely to develop amongst people toward that one person? You ever thought about that? I haven't had huge responsibilities like when I think of my working life or whatever, but what develops when you lead a group of people, if you make all the decisions and don't share the burden, is, oh, he's a dictator. You know, can't do anything unless he tells it to do. You can't, you know, this thing comes up that who does he think he is? I've got some good ideas here. And my ideas never get anywhere because they're not his ideas. You see how these things develop? But when others, when you come up, okay, fine, you figure it out this time and you let somebody else do it or get a group of people to be involved in it, all of a sudden they realize there were a lot more issues to this issue, to the things that were in front of them, than what they realize. And they go, okay, yeah, you really can't do that, can you? That would have seemed so wonderful, but yeah, that just won't work. And so they get to see a different perspective. And there's a lot of people involved in this plan, right? And we're looking at a big group of people, so there's going to be a lot of under judges or people dealing with smaller groups. And there's a lot of wisdom in what he says here. They will share the load. That's a big deal, both in terms of the labor, as well as it's going to give them a perspective of what it means to make these kinds of decisions, that as they understand what it's like to walk in your shoes And somebody else comes along and goes, that jerk Moses led us over here again and we got a mess. And, you know, well, slow down. We'll get it taken care of. You know, it just, it gets a team going there that will work better. And I like verse 23 a lot. If you do this and God commands it, you will endure. He doesn't leave God out of this picture. He says, if you do this and God endorses it, or God directs it that this is a good path to take, you're going to endure it. And this other piece, I think, goes back to sharing the load, and the people will go home in peace. Moses could render a good judgment, but if he's doing all the judging, after a while people are going to resent him dealing with everything. They're not going to see that there's a broader perspective here. And so now this pattern will honor God yet. It will still be allowing the teaching that needs to occur, and it's going to contribute to the harmony of the camp. Questions, comments, thoughts? So let's go on to verse 24. Moses listened. And without getting off on some personal gripe about life, I love that. I'm sure that many people have dealt to me and said, he didn't hear a word I said. And I don't want to be that way. I want to be a good listener. But I've dealt with people that you talk and they've already got their mind made up or whatever, and they just really don't get it. They don't listen. But Moses heard it. He got it. And as a result, he did what was suggested. He chose the men. He put them in charge just in the pattern that he was suggested. And they did the judging, bringing the very difficult things to Moses. If it was minor, they took care of it themselves. And so I'm just going to say one little quick thing there, that listening is a skill that it's more than hearing words. It's goes to the level of understanding. And a lot of us want to talk more than we want to hear. Guilty. So that's a good skill to have as well. And then we get to verse 27. And Moses said farewell to Jethro. And Jethro went his way to his own land, meaning back to his home there in Midian, and away from the mountain of God, which is also in Midian, but not where his home was. I tried to find another mention in the scriptures of Jethro or Zipporah, and I didn't find it anywhere else. It's almost like the scriptures go silent on Jethro and Zipporah. I thought maybe we would see another time when they came up, but this seems to be the end of their interaction. And so not again in scriptures. Thoughts? Okay.
The first one is chapter 18 chronologically before chapter 19?
Well, I took it that way. Do I know? I don't know that I know, because there are occasions here where it talks about the 40 years that we've already mentioned that God's going to provide the manna. So I thought so. I thought it was as Moses was approaching the mountain. That's a good question. Yeah.
And does that possibly relate back to 1634, where the manna was laid up before the testimony, which is in capital T?
I think it does relate back. And
I would think official laws and commands of God.
Well, and now it's going
to
take me. Yeah, it does appear before Mount Sinai. Now, I need to get my, I don't know if I can focus on it. I can find things at home that when I'm standing up in front of you, I get nervous and can't find. But in chapter 16, when God is introducing manna, he says this is going to be a test. And somewhere in there, it talks about, and I'm going to establish statutes and ordinances. And the things that in the context of that chapter that it establishes are the rules about gathering manna. That seems minor to me. And also how to handle the meat and so on. But the big one is the Sabbath. And so I think we see the foundation, a few foundational rules given. And that's what I think is going on there. I think there's something a whole lot more to that testimony, but I have trouble finding what to say about it from a scriptural perspective. Clearly they had something that they were looking at. Well, I think
not new to Moses or the Israelites. It was the actual written down on stone from God what he had already given to Moses.
So I haven't. I think it's possible. I haven't studied from that perspective. So if I did, I might find something that would cause me to move away from that. But one of the things I would go to goes clear back to the beginning of the book of Genesis when we have Cain and Abel. God asked for a sacrifice. I don't see any words in Genesis where he said the sacrifice needs to be a living sacrifice animal, but Cain and Abel both knew. And so there's a lot given to mankind. We can't obviously talk about Abraham, but there's a lot given to mankind right out of the box that we don't get much detail about the expanse of what those rules were or what specifically they were. And I think that it's very clear as we get even into the time of Moses' birth. I don't think you have to tell these people not to kill, not to steal. I mean, there's some rules that I think they would all agree come from God. Now, we would have trouble in our day saying these are rules that come from God. But we wouldn't have any problem saying, well, these are obviously rights and wrongs. And so, I don't have anything to say that they didn't already have those Ten Commandments. They may have, and God may have said, "I'm going to give them to you in this form." I do think it appears that the specific Sabbath worship thing did start in chapter 16. I don't think we see that in that form in the scriptures elsewhere, but before that. Now, I would have to go do a search, but it certainly appears that God talks about the Sabbath and the concept of the Sabbath, and he rested. I think in Genesis, the main thing about his resting is, it's done. And by taking the day of rest, I think he's saying, it's done. It wasn't that, you know, a lot more to do with regard to creation. Creation's done. And then he moved on from there. I don't know if I'm making much sense, but that's kind of the way I look. They very well may have had the Ten Commandments in one form or another before he formalized it on the mountain. It's very clear that one of the things that's happening on the mountain, we're not there yet, but one of the things that happens on the mountain is God's going to draw a strong, strong covenant with the people with very specific things that they need to do in order to retain the blessing of God. And he gives them both the blessing and the curse depending upon how they react to those. And he gets pretty detailed before they're done with the whole thing. It doesn't all come out of those Ten Commandments. I mean, there's all the laws that get put there. So I don't mean to act ignorant, but I don't want to speak for the scriptures where they didn't actually say something either. Good questions. Anybody else? I've got one thought I want to leave you with out of this passage. And that is, when we're involved in our lives are ministries on God's behalf, right? Is there anyone who lives as a servant of Jesus Christ and of God that isn't involved in ministry? Now, I don't mean necessarily vocational ministry, but certainly we're all involved in the Great Commission. We're all involved in making disciples. We're all involved in showing the love of Christ to one another. You've got all the one another's of Scripture. We've got a whole dedication going on in the next room that I highly, highly am excited about, where we are involved in caring for one another as believers in Christ. And here's Moses, and he's been called in a specific way. He knows exactly what his focus is with God and the people. He's there to lead him, and God even told him, I'm going to hold you accountable to get them to the promised land. Clear back when the plagues were going on, God made that statement. We could go back and find it if I wasn't in a hurry. And out of Moses' ministry, Moses is almost, you get the idea here, at least on this issue, kind of blindly plodding along. Jethro didn't come here with some grand revelation from God. Jethro just took a look around and goes, this isn't going to work. We got to figure out. I've got to figure out. God would want you to do something that's more thought out than this. And so I think it's an endorsement of our own initiative, using what wisdom God has given us, even in a worldly way. Now, it's very clear that God's not left out of this plan. If God blesses you, if God commands it, then this would be a good plan. And I think Jethro intended for Moses to involve God in implementing this plan, or even deciding if it's a good plan. And so shame on us if we don't stop and give consideration to how to do our ministry, how to make our service to Christ not as good as we can make it. You know, how could I rearrange my life so that things get done better? How could I involve other people in doing this so that I'm not just handing out fish, but I also get to teach people to fish along the way? And so I think this is an endorsement of us taking all that we are and using it all for Christ and his kingdom. Comments, thoughts? All right, well, next time we're going to find ourselves at the foot of Mount Sinai and the beginnings of the things that go on there.